Small towns that once relied on coal mines are seeing the opportunities in another industry, recreation.
People ask me all the time, does that trail help you out? And I said, the trail's the reason I'm here. You know, that's why we're here.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, bed and breakfasts and outfitters are starting to fill an economic void in communities as other industries disappear. Plus, environmentalists protest the Trump administration's move to cancel the plan that reduces carbon emissions from power plants.
As a mom, I must stand up in support of the Clean Power Plan. Climate change is real. It's happening right now.
But states and energy companies are moving forward with their own renewable energy plans. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pittsburgh's Lawrenceville neighborhood is having a moment. In recent years, the densely populated neighborhood with its new boutiques and restaurants has earned the distinction of coolest neighborhood in America by Lonely Planet. But there's something besides gentrification in the air. Benzene, manganese, and carbon monoxide. They're coming from McConway and Torley, a nearby steel foundry that's been making parts for the railroad industry since 1868. The Allegheny County Health Department is currently reviewing a draft operating permit for the company, and they held a public hearing recently to get input from the community. The Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis reports on the clash between a legacy industry and worries about air pollution.
About 150 people showed up to the Allegheny County Health Department's hearing December 4th, a mix of residents, environmental activists, and a school bus load of McConway and Torley employees. James Gandy has been a material handler at the plant for 25 years.
While Lawrenceville is changing, residents should respect the fact that this is an industrial complex and an industrial area.
The draft operating permit for McConway and Torley allows the company to produce 92,500 tons of steel a year and sets limits for carbon monoxide and benzene and manganese, a neurotoxin. As currently written, the permit would require the company to test its emissions every 5 years. Many residents believe that's not enough. Phoebe Stern lives a few blocks away.
I have young neighbors going through crucial development stages. 5 years to identify an issue could be too late for them if there is, in fact, a public health impact.
The permit has been delayed for 2 years while the company made upgrades to lower its emissions. In a letter sent to all households within a 3-mile radius of the factory, McConway and Torley said that they've invested more than $63 million in facility improvements over the past 10 years. $23 million of that was earmarked for environmental and emission control equipment like bag houses. Those are the big vacuums that filter pollutants. A neighborhood group, Lawrenceville United, wants the health department to test that it's working with monitors for heavy metals at the fence line and to study the potential health effects of plant emissions on nearby residents.
I didn't have asthma when I moved to Pittsburgh. I have asthma now.
Thomas Crown moved to Lawrenceville from Seattle 10 years ago. He lives about 3 blocks from the foundry and doesn't trust the health department to protect residents.
And I can tell when they're gaming the system because some nights the sleeping is just fine. Other nights, I wake up in the morning and I'm a wreck. I have an air quality monitor on my roof. I'm watching you.
McConway and Torley employs 380 people locally, but is owned by Trinity Industries in Texas. The health department officials say they will consider the comments before issuing a final permit. They could not provide a timeline for when it could be expected. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
The Department of Energy has proposed a plan to keep coal and nuclear plants from shutting down by shifting costs to ratepayers. The idea is popular with a few local energy companies. But reporting for State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found a broad range of industries and groups opposing it.
This fall, the Department of Energy proposed a rule that could help the beleaguered coal and nuclear industries. Their plants are closing because they simply can't compete with dirt-cheap natural gas and, increasingly, renewables. The rule would put a premium on the electricity generated by so-called fuel-secure power plants, namely coal and nuclear. This is how Rick Perry, the Secretary of the Department of Energy, spelled it out recently.
Can you guarantee me tomorrow that the wind's going to blow? Can you guarantee me tomorrow that the sun's going to shine? Can you guarantee me tomorrow that a gas pipeline's not going to be disrupted in some form or fashion? And the answer is no.
The plan would force grid operators and eventually ratepayers to guarantee payments to electricity companies whose plants can keep 90 days of fuel on site. Perry says that would protect the grid from power shortages from man-made or natural disasters. But many question whether this 90-day rule is necessary.
There's never been anything remotely close to a disruption that would require 90 days of supply on the ground until things could get back on their feet.
Dan Klein analyzes coal for the firm S&P Global Platts. He sees the rule as a way to boost the nuclear and coal industries. And a broad array of interest groups, from the oil and gas industry to wind and solar producers, oppose it. The plan would impact northeastern states the most. The cost of the rule could go into the billions, according to several estimates. The Department of Energy has asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to act on its proposal. Reporting for State Impact Pennsylvania, I'm Reed Frazier.
The coal industry cheered the Trump administration's EPA at recent hearings in West Virginia for the agency's move to repeal the Clean Power Plan. That Obama-era rule would have reduced greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. But Glynis Board reports that most energy analysts don't think the plan's repeal will really make much difference.
Everyone knows that the fight against the unlawful Clean Power Plan started in Charleston, West Virginia.
West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrisey, who is also running for U.S. Senate, spoke to about 120 coal miners and coal advocates in front of the state's capitol. Inside, the EPA was conducting its only scheduled public hearing on repealing the Clean Power Plan. The federal rule would have required states to find ways to ratchet down power plant emissions.
And we took action when no one thought little old West Virginia could lead and accomplish things.
Almost 300 signed up to talk at the EPA hearing, many from grassroots organizations like Danielle Walker of Morgantown, West Virginia, who represented Moms Clean Air Force.
As a mom, I must stand up in support of the Clean Power Plan. Climate change is real. It's happening right now. And we need to take action as a nation.
Several speakers also indicated that they believed the hearing was more about politics than policy. Many energy analysts and utility experts agree and say rapidly developing technology, market forces, and public pressure matter more in the shifting energy landscape than the fate of the Clean Power Plan. Gavin Bade reports for Utility Drive, which monitors the electricity sector. He authored a report this year, and based on a survey of utility leaders, he says companies are continuing to shift toward cleaner, more distributed energy, and they aren't likely to shift back.
It's a good political story for Scott Pruitt leading the EPA to go to Charleston, West Virginia, and to slap around the Clean Power Plan of the Obama administration. But the fact is very little, if not nothing, is changing in the power sector because of his repeal of the Clean Power Plan.
Bade's report predicts that due to competition from natural gas and other factors, coal will continue to lose in the electric generation markets, regardless of environmental regulation.
No one with a straight face who knows what they're talking about in the utility sector is going to tell you that a new coal plant is going to be built in this country. It's just not going to happen. And if it does, I will eat my keyboard.
The dominant trend has been a shift from coal to natural gas, something the Tennessee Valley Authority did this year at its iconic Paradise facility in Kentucky. On a tour of the new gas-fired facility earlier this year, TVA spokesperson Scott Brooks said those decisions have more to do with business factors than politics.
Most of the things that are in place right now in TVA service territory, the closing of some of our coal plants, the creation and bringing on gas plants, the nuclear plants, were all decisions that were made 2011 and before, so certainly prior to the current administration.
Several analysts say the policy is having an effect at the state level, if not the federal. Environmental law professor William Busby, a Georgetown University Law Center, explains that clean energy trends are accelerating because of state initiatives.
In the clean energy sphere, the reason there has been so much progress has been due to state leadership in much of the country. And that is likely to continue even if the federal government steps back from its personal leadership role.
In the Ohio Valley, only Pennsylvania and Ohio have binding goals for renewable or alternative energy. Kentucky and West Virginia considered such plans under Democratic governors, but abandoned them under current Republican leadership. West Virginia native Walton Shepard is an energy staff attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's been working with other states in the region, like Virginia, to adopt state versions of the Clean Power Plan.
Soon after Donald Trump was elected president, and we knew that he was going to roll back federal action on climate change, the governor in Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe, decided, hey, you know, we're going to do something about climate change in Virginia. If the federal government is going to stand on the sidelines and abdicate its international leadership as well, we'll do it here.
Virginia adopted regulations that limit emissions from the power sector and auctions off allowances. Proceeds get invested in energy efficiency, renewable energy, or other consumer benefit programs. James Van Nostrand directs the Center for Energy and Sustainable Development at West Virginia University. He explains that investment in renewable energy not only improves the market for ratepayers, it also gives states an edge when it comes to attracting new industry.
A lot of these companies, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, they have goals of achieving a percentage of their electricity supply from renewable sources. And even some of the bricks and mortar companies, Procter & Gamble, Walmart, Toyota, they have renewable energy goals. And here in West Virginia, it's 95% coal-fired. And if we can't meet the demands of these large employers for a renewable energy supply, we're not going to attract those jobs.
Van Nostrand is part of a collaboration working to re-envision the economic future of West Virginia. He hopes politics don't stand in the way of his group's research and business findings. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board.
Ohio Valley Resource is a public media collaboration supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, some are trying to get the word out that coal and even natural gas aren't the only resources that can be moneymakers in our region.
The resource here is the landscape and all the recreational opportunities.
Even amid the sound of coal train whistles, trails and kayaking are helping small towns rebuild and plan for a future that depends on nature. That's coming up later. Stay tuned. So you might have heard that the Allegheny Front is now part of State Impact Pennsylvania. It's the public media collaboration focused on the state's energy issues. And our partners are WESA, WITF, and WHYY. One lucky part of this new arrangement is that we get to work with Amy Sisk. She's a new reporter with WESA and State Impact Pennsylvania. Amy's just moved to Pittsburgh from North Dakota, where she's been covering the energy industry, including coal, oil, and wind. And she has a connection to southwestern Pennsylvania.
So my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, the grandfather, that ancestor, he fought in the Revolutionary War. So they're buried in Greene County. And so a couple weekends ago, I went to go find their graves in the cemetery. And I went out there, found their graves, and right next to that cemetery was a natural gas well.
We thought it would be interesting to talk with Amy Sisk about the differences and similarities regarding energy development in our region and in North Dakota, and how she'll be approaching her beat here. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
First, what kind of influence do the oil and coal industries have in North Dakota? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
I would say quite a lot. Revenue that the state collects from oil makes up a huge chunk of the state budget. So it's really an important resource for the state. People are pretty welcoming of fossil fuel development in North Dakota simply because it fuels the economy and provides a lot of jobs. And I think one thing that's important to understand about a state like North Dakota is that 10 years ago, you know, the population of a lot of the small towns that are in the oil patch out there was shrinking. People were leaving. There wasn't a lot to keep people there. Then with the shale fracking boom, that just brought a huge influx of people to these communities and sort of revitalized them.
Yeah, so North Dakota, the fracking there is fracking for oil, whereas we're fracking for natural gas here.
That's very true. And a little bit of natural gas does come up with the oil in North Dakota, but it's by and large oil.
renewable energy is also big in North Dakota.
We've seen this huge increase in the number of wind farms that have gone up in the state in the last 10 years. I believe there's about 24 wind farms now. 22% of the electricity in North Dakota is generated by wind. And compare that to a decade ago, only 2% of the state's electricity was generated from wind. And it got to the point that a couple months ago, it seems like every time when I would get on the interstate to drive across the state, I would see, you know, trucks hauling these gigantic wind turbine parts to set up at some new wind farm. It just seemed like every single time I got on that interstate, you would see that traffic.
Is there like a renewable versus fossil fuels kind of feeling there, or is it sort of all seen as one big picture?
So a lot of people within the energy industry in North Dakota, regardless of whether they work for oil or coal or wind, talk about an all-of-the-above energy strategy that needs to encompass both renewables and fossil fuel. However, there is a lot of tension in the state, particularly between wind and coal, since they're both sources of electricity generation. And we saw that really this past legislative session with some lawmakers that were wanting to ensure some stability for the coal industry there, trying to, you know, impose laws that would hurt the wind industry. So, for example, there was an effort to try to impose a 2-year moratorium on new wind farms. That ultimately failed, but we saw a lot of efforts like that.
Okay, I know the biggest story that you covered in North Dakota was the Dakota Access Pipeline. We aired some of your reporting here on our show.
Yep.
And the Dakota Access Pipeline is, of course, an underground pipeline that carries oil from what they call the Bakken in North Dakota through the Midwest to Illinois. And last year, its construction, or one final piece of it, was the site of a huge protest by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and environmentalists over concerns about potential water contamination. So what was it like to cover that story? You must have a lot of stories about it.
I absolutely do. It was a very intense experience. And so I covered this starting in about August of 2016. And the pipeline protests that were happening kind of on the border of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation near where this pipeline was going to cross underneath the Missouri River, those really lasted from about August until February, when ultimately the governor of North Dakota sent law enforcement in to kick out the remaining protesters. So I covered that story pretty much every single day for those 7 months, and it was such an experience. I think the one day that really stands out to me was October 27th, 2016, and it was a day that pipeline protesters had set up a camp on private property right at the site of pipeline construction, and police went in to raid that camp and force the protesters off of that private property. And I got down there and just saw this sight that I had never seen before, and just this huge police presence. So police in riot gear, dozens of Humvees and armored vehicles.
Surveillance helicopters are circling above as I stand next to a makeshift roadblock of beat-up cars, tires, and wooden pallets. Protesters lit it on fire, and you can still see and smell the smoke. They were trying to keep police out, but police have since pushed protesters back and are trying to get them to move further down the highway.
We won't have it anymore. This is our stand. We'll stand, and we'll stop this pipeline.
And that was the day that I realized that North Dakota was going to have to go through a lot of healing as a result of all the tension that bubbled up over the pipeline protest.
Hmm. What did that experience teach you about environmental reporting or covering energy issues?
So I think before the Dakota Access Pipeline protests happened, I was very focused on how people felt about energy development in North Dakota. And then when the pipeline protests happened, it brought all these people from not just across the country, but across the world, who were very concerned about environmental issues to North Dakota to try to advocate against this pipeline. And so it made me very aware that, you know, in the future, as I'm reporting on these issues, I shouldn't just be talking with people in the communities that are affected. I also need to take into consideration this broader context of how people, you know, elsewhere feel about these issues.
Okay, well, now you're in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And you've had a little bit of time, I know, to explore your energy beat here. What are your first impressions? How How different is it from North Dakota?
So in some ways, it's very similar. A lot of drilling and a lot of fracking. However, there's a couple things that really strike me as different. So I've had a chance to meet with some environmental organizations on my first couple weeks here in this job, and I'm just amazed at the number of environmental organizations that exist in the state. In North Dakota, there's just very few environmental groups advocating, you know, against fossil fuel development. And so that's one big difference I see here. The other thing is that gas development in Pennsylvania is like literally happening in people's backyards. It's happening, you know, very close to people's homes and communities, businesses. And in North Dakota, the state is just so much more rural, and these towns are just so much more remote that there's really not a need to drill, you know, very close to people's homes. And so a lot of the drilling that you see is happening, you know, much, much further away. Here, it's literally in people's backyards, and that's something I hadn't seen before.
Thanks, Amy. We'll be looking forward to hearing what you come up with.
Great. Thank you.
Amy Sisk is a reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania, and you'll be hearing a lot more from her, along with all of the State Impact team, like our own Reed Frazier, here on the Allegheny Front and at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Carol Holsapple. There's a national storyline that's told about parts of West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and it goes like this. As the steel and coal industries fade, small towns here are literally dying out. Young people move away because of a lack of jobs. But for the past 20 years, some entrepreneurs have been quietly working on a different narrative, one that harnesses the area's natural beauty to build the economy. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that their slow climb is starting to bear real economic fruit.
About 10 years ago, after a long career in computer sales, Rod Darby was downsized and out of work.
And I got angry about that, so I thought I'm never going to work for somebody else again, so I'm going to go start my own business.
As he researched what that business would be, he started noticing a lot of activity around the Great Allegheny Passage, a 150-mile bike trail along an old rail line connecting Pittsburgh to Cumberland, Maryland. Construction was still in progress then, but it's since been completed. Darby wrote up a business plan to open a bar and restaurant along the trail in West Newton. It's about 30 miles south of Pittsburgh. He shopped the idea around.
I went to a large bank. They said, nope, that's not what we do. Went to a medium-sized bank. Hey, great plan. That's not what we do. Went to a small bank. Great plan. We're not sure about this trail.
Then he went to a community development program called the Progress Fund.
And they said, this is exactly what we do. And they've been a fantastic partner for me since we started.
David Cayley, co-founder of the Progress Fund, saw a need to support tourism in the region 20 years ago.
So we started basically a nonprofit bank and started making loans to small businesses.
Funded by a variety of state and federal agencies, private foundations, and commercial banks, they initially invested in nearby Ohio Pile, financing a whitewater rafting facility, a bed and breakfast, and other tourism projects. Today, it's bustling with cyclists, hikers, and rafters spending money to eat, shop, and stay overnight. Kaylee wanted to try something similar in West Newton, which is only a 34-mile bike ride from Pittsburgh. Then Rod Darby walked in the door.
Rod became one of the first people outside of Ohio Pile to start investing in the other little towns. So when he approached and said, I want to do something here, we were jumping for joy.
Today, Darby's Trailside Restaurant serves pub food, boasts a full bar, and a takeout beer shop.
Any particular flavor, Dave?
28 people work here, 16 full-time. And Darby says business is hopping.
People ask me all the time, does that trail help you out? And I said, the trail's the reason I'm here.
The Progress Fund's David Cayley walks just a few feet from the restaurant onto that bike trail that runs along the river.
We have all these nifty signs so you don't get lost.
The fund invested in pizza and fast food restaurants here, a kayak shop, and the renovation of a bed and breakfast.
Well, we have 9 loans that we've done in West Newton, and it's really that kind of level of investment's changing West Newton's future around tourism. Why 9 loans here? Well, that Great Allegheny Passage is a huge economic opportunity.
Based on studies and surveys over 17 years, the Progress Fund estimates nearly 1 million people use the Gap Trail each year. And according to the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, it generates more than $40 million in revenue annually. As the steel and coal industries have declined, Kaley says West Newton and other towns in the region have faced years of disinvestment. He says the Progress Fund is trying to help them see what they do have to offer.
The resource here is the landscape and all the recreational opportunities. So it is a fully invested economic development program, but it's one that relies on the environmental aspects or environmental qualities of the community rather than being the extractive industry.
Walking down the trail, the tracks are gone, but the old train station has been renovated into a new visitor center.
Hey, wake up.
Who's here? Hi.
Hi.
The Bright Morning Bed and Breakfast is just a few steps away. Mary Lou Randulik and her husband have renovated a series of late Victorian-era homes conveniently located for cyclists.
Common area, living room, kitchen.
She walks me to an outdoor patio that looks almost like it could become a restaurant. They even have a liquor license.
So we're walking from one B&B to the next.
It's like a campus.
When they first moved in, Randulik says the nearby train station was still dilapidated. This was literally considered the wrong side of the rail tracks when she was growing up across the river in West Newton.
When I bought the first one and I moved in, I remember thinking, what did I do? I bought a house in the place in town where nobody would ever go.
But she soon started hearing from friends who enjoyed the trail access and wanted a place to stay. Randulik and her husband started renovating with the bed and breakfast in mind. The Progress Fund helped as they continued to expand. Now all four Bright Morning houses stay busy with overnight guests.
I don't have a number, but we've had night after night after night, and it can be any day of the week.
Kent Spellman is encouraged by the results of the Progress Fund. He's pushing for this kind of development along West Virginia's abandoned train tracks, too.
I'm a consultant with the Rails to Trails Conservancy out of Washington, D.C.
Spellman has spent most of his life in West Virginia. He says some communities are suffering from something like post-traumatic stress disorder because of the loss of industry in recent decades.
Their future, too often, in southern West Virginia, but also in many northern West Virginia communities, has been determined by that big extractive industry, or that big steel mill, or that big chemical company. Those things are going away, and it's, I think, a time for us in rural Appalachia to start understanding that we have to take responsibility for our future ourselves.
Spellman is currently focused on completing a 230-mile rail trail from Parkersburg to Morgantown, hooking up with the Great Allegheny Passage into Pittsburgh. He sees rail trails as the new Main Street, the place where people walk their dogs and talk with neighbors. He says the cycling tourism is important and can showcase the beauty and livability of West Virginia, but it's really just a means to build a broader economy.
And if we get just a small percentage of the people who come through our communities to be thinking down the road about maybe that would be a good place to rear a family, maybe that would be a good place to bring my small business, that is the goal of tourism.
Mary Popovich agrees. She's the mayor of West Newton and today sits at a beautifully renovated downtown building looking out onto the Youghiogheny. She says thanks to the trail and the economic development around it, there's excitement in her old coal town. Even the elementary school that almost closed is now seeing increased enrollment.
There's a lot of houses that are getting sold to young families. This is how you help your community grow in numbers, and then you're going to get more businesses.
The Progress Fund has invested a lot in West Newton, hoping other former coal towns will look here and start reimagining their futures as trail towns. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. And you can always find us at AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.